of carbon dioxide in the air has risen by 40% over the last two centuries, while the concentration of methane, an even more potent greenhouse gas, has more than doubled. Because of these anthropogenic emissions, Crutzen wrote, the global climate is likely to depart significantly from natural behavior for many millennia to come. Crutzen published Geology of Mankind in 2002. Soon, the Anthropocene began migrating out into other scientific journals. Global analysis of river systems, from Earth system controls to Anthropocene syndromes, was the title of a 2003 article in the journal Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society B. Soils and Sediments in the Anthropocene ran the headline of a piece from 2004 in the Journal of Soils and Sediments. When Zalashevich came across the term, he was intrigued. He noticed that most of those using it were not trained stratigraphers, and he wondered how his colleagues felt about this. At the time, he was head of the Stratigraphy Committee of the Geological Society of London, the body Lyell and also William Wowell and John Phillips once presided over. At a luncheon meeting, Zalashevich asked his fellow committee members what they thought of the Anthropocene. 21 out of the 22 thought that the concept had merit. The group decided to examine the idea as a formal problem in geology. Would the Anthropocene satisfy the criteria used for naming a new epoch? To geologists, an epoch is a subdivision of a period, which in turn is a division of an era. The Holocene, for instance, is an epoch of the Quaternary, which is a period in the Cenozoic. The answer the members arrived at after a year's worth of study was an unqualified yes. The sorts of changes that Crutzen had enumerated would, they decided, leave behind a global stratigraphic signature that would still be legible millions of years from now, the same way that, say, the Ordovician glaciation left behind a stratigraphic signature that is still legible today. Among other things, the members of the group observed in a paper summarizing their findings, the Anthropocene will be marked by a unique biostratigraphical signal, a product of the current extinction event on the one hand, and of the human propensity for redistributing life on the other. This signal will be permanently inscribed, they wrote, as future evolution will take place from surviving and frequently anthropogenically relocated stocks, or, as Zalashevich would have it, rats. By the time of my visit to Scotland, Zalashevich had taken the case for the Anthropocene to the next level. The International Commission on Stratigraphy, or ICS, is the group responsible for maintaining the official timetable of Earth's history. It's the ICS that settles such matters as, when exactly did the Pleistocene begin? After much heated debate, the Commission recently moved that epoch start date back from 1.8 to 2.6 million years ago. Zalashevich had convinced the ICS to look into formally recognizing the Anthropocene, an effort that, logically enough, he himself was put in charge of. As head of the Anthropocene Working Group, Zalashevich is hoping to bring a proposal to a vote by the full body in 2016. If he's successful, and the Anthropocene is adopted as a new epoch, every geology textbook in the world immediately will become obsolete. Chapter 6. The Sea Around Us. Patella Carolea. Castella Argonese is a tiny island that rises straight out of the Tyrrhenian Sea, like a turret. 18 miles west of Naples, it can be reached from the larger island of Ischia via a long, narrow stone bridge. At the end of the bridge, there's a booth where 10 euros buys a ticket that allows you to climb, or better yet, take the elevator, up to the massive castle that gives the island its name. The castle houses a display of medieval torture instruments, as well as a fancy hotel and an outdoor cafe. On a summer evening, the cafe is supposed to be a pleasant place to sip Campari and contemplate the terrors of the past. Like many small places, Castello Argonese is a product of very large forces, in this case, the northward drift of Africa, which every year brings Tripoli an inch or so closer to Rome. Along a complicated set of folds, the African plate is pressing into Eurasia, the way a sheet of metal might be forced into a furnace. Occasionally, this process results in violent volcanic eruptions. One such eruption, in 1302, led the entire population of Ischia to take refuge on Castello Argonese. On a more regular basis, it sends streams of gas bubbling out of vents in the sea floor. This gas, as it happens, is almost 100% carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide has many interesting properties, one of which is that it dissolves in water to form an acid. I have come to Ischia in late January, deep into the off-season, specifically to swim in its bubbly, acidified bay. Two marine biologists, Jason Hall Spencer and Maria Cristina Buia, have promised to show me the vents, provided the predicted rainstorm holds off. It is a raw, gray day, and we are thumping along in a fishing boat that's been converted into a research vessel. We round Castello Argonese and anchor about 20 yards from its rocky cliffs. From the boat, I can't see the vents, but I can see signs of them. A whitish band of barnacles runs all the way around the base of the island, except above the vents, where the barnacles are missing. "Barnacles are pretty tough," Hall Spencer observes. He is British, with dirty blonde hair that sticks up in unpredictable directions. He's wearing a dry suit, which is sort of a wetsuit designed to keep its owner from ever getting wet, and it makes him look as if he's preparing for a space journey. Buia is Italian, with reddish-brown hair that reaches her shoulders. She strips down to her bathing suit and pulls on her wetsuit with one expert motion. I try to emulate her with a suit I have borrowed for the occasion. It is, I learn as I tug at the zipper, about a half size too small. We all put on masks and flippers and flop in. The water is frigid. Hall Spencer is carrying a knife. He pries some sea urchins from a rock and holds them out to me. Their spines are an inky black. We swim on, along the southern shore of the island, toward the vents. Hall Spencer and Buia keep pausing to gather samples. Corals, snails, seaweeds, mussels, which they place in mesh sacks that drag behind them in the water. When we get close enough, I start to see bubbles rising from the sea floor, like beads of quicksilver. Beds of seagrass wave beneath us. The blades are a peculiarly vivid green. This, I later learn, is because the tiny organisms that usually coat them, dulling their color, are missing. The closer we get to the vents, the less there is to collect. The sea urchins drop away, and so too do the mussels and the barnacles. Buia finds some hapless limpets attached to the cliff. Their shells have wasted away almost to the point of transparency. Swarms of jellyfish waft by, just a shade paler than the sea. "Watch out," Hall Spencer warns. "They sting." Since the start of the Industrial Revolution, humans have burned through enough fossil fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas, to add some 365 billion metric tons of carbon to the atmosphere. Deforestation has contributed to another 180 billion tons. Each year, we throw up another 9 billion tons or so, an amount that's been increasing by as much as 6% annually. As a result of all this, the concentration of carbon dioxide in the air today, a little over 400 parts per million, is higher than at any other point in the last 800,000 years. Quite probably, It is higher than at any point in the last several million years. If current trends continue, CO2 concentrations will top 500 parts per million, roughly double the levels they were in pre-industrial days, by 2050. It is expected that such an increase will provide an eventual average global temperature rise of between 3.5 and 7 degrees Fahrenheit, and this will, in turn, trigger a variety of world-altering events, including the disappearance of most remaining glaciers, the inundation of low-lying islands and coastal cities, and the melting of the Arctic ice cap. But this is only half the story. Ocean covers 70% of the Earth's surface, and everywhere that water and air come into contact, there's an exchange. Gases from the atmosphere get absorbed by the ocean, and gases dissolved in the ocean are released into the atmosphere. When the two are in equilibrium, roughly the same quantities are being dissolved as are being released. Change the atmosphere's composition, as we have done, and the exchange becomes lopsided. More carbon dioxide enters the water than comes back out. In this way, humans are constantly adding CO2 to the seas, much as the vents do, but from above rather than below, and on a global scale. This year alone, the oceans will absorb 2.5 billion tons of carbon, and next year it is expected they will absorb another 2.5 billion tons. Every day, every American in effect pumps 7 pounds of carbon into the sea. Thanks to all this extra CO2, the pH of the ocean's surface waters has already dropped from an average of around 8.2 to an average of around 8.1. Like the Richter scale, the pH scale is logarithmic, so even such a small numerical difference represents a very large real-world change. A decline of 0.1 means that the oceans are now 30% more acidic than they were in 1800. Assuming that humans continue to burn fossil fuels, the oceans will continue to absorb carbon dioxide and will become increasingly acidified. Under what's known as a business-as-usual emissions scenario, surface ocean pH will fall to 8.0 by the middle of this century, and it will drop to 7.8 by the century's end. At that point, the oceans will be 150% more acidic than they were at the start of the Industrial Revolution. The pH scale runs from 0 to 14. 7 is neutral. Anything above that is basic, and below it, acidic. Seawater is naturally basic, so as the pH falls, the process usually referred to as ocean acidification could, less catchily, be called a decline in ocean alkalinity. Owing to the CO2 pouring out of the vents, the waters around Castello Argonese provide a near-perfect preview of what lies ahead for the oceans more generally, which is why I am paddling around the island in January, gradually growing numb from the cold. Here it is possible to swim, even, I think in a moment of panic, to drown, in the seas of tomorrow, today. By the time we get back to the harbor in Ischia, the wind has come up. The deck is a clutter of spent air tanks, dripping wetsuits, and chests full of samples. Once unloaded, everything has to be lugged through the narrow streets and up to the local marine biological station, which occupies a steep promontory overlooking the sea. The station was founded by a 19th-century German naturalist named Anton Dorn. Hanging on the wall in the entrance hall, I notice, is a copy of a letter Charles Darwin sent to Dorn in 1874. In it, Darwin expresses dismay at having heard, through a mutual friend, that Dorn is overworked. Installed in tanks in a basement laboratory, the animals Boya and Hall Spencer gathered from around Castello Argonese at first appear inert, to my untrained eye, possibly even dead. But after a while, they set about waggling their tentacles and scavenging for food. there was a starfish missing a leg, and a lump of rather rangy-looking coral, and some sea urchins, which move around their tanks on dozens of thread-like tube feet. Each tube foot is controlled hydraulically, extending and retracting in response to water pressure. There is also a 6-inch-long sea cucumber, which bears an unfortunate resemblance to a blood sausage, or worse yet, a turd. In the chilly lab, the destructive effect of the vents is plain. Ocellinus turbinatus is a common Mediterranean snail, with a shell of alternating black and white splotches arranged in a snakeskin-like pattern. The Ocellinus turbinatus in the tank has no pattern. The ridged outer layer of its shell has been eaten away, exposing the smooth, all-white layer underneath. The limpet Patella carolea is shaped like a Chinese straw hat. Several Patella carolea shells have deep lesions through which their owners' putty-colored bodies can be seen. They looked as if they have been dunked in acid, which in a manner of speaking, they have. Because it's so important, we humans put a lot of energy into making sure that the pH of our blood is constant, Hall Spencer says, raising his voice to be heard over the noise of the running water. But some of these lower organisms, they don't have the physiology to do that. They've just got to tolerate what's happening outside, and so they get pushed beyond their limits. Later, over pizza, Hall Spencer tells me about his first trip to the vents. That was in the summer of 2002, when he was working on an Italian research vessel called Urania. One hot day, the Urania was passing by Ischia when the crew decided to anchor and go for a swim. Some of the Italian scientists who knew about the vents took Hall Spencer to see them, just for the fun of it. He enjoyed the novelty of the experience. Swimming through the bubbles is a bit like bathing in champagne. But beyond that, it set him thinking. At the time, marine biologists were just beginning to recognize the hazards posed by acidification. Some disturbing calculations had been done, and some preliminary experiments performed on animals raised in labs. It occurred to Hall Spencer that the vents could be used for a new and more ambitious sort of study. This one would involve not just a few species reared in tanks, but dozens of species living and breeding in their natural, or if you prefer, naturally unnatural, environment. At Castello Argonese, the vents produce a pH gradient. On the eastern edge of the island, the waters are more or less unaffected. This zone might be thought of as the Mediterranean of the present. As you move closer to the vents, the acidity of the water increases and the pH declines. A map of life along this pH gradient, Hall Spencer reasoned, would represent a map of what lies ahead for the world's oceans. It would be like having access to an underwater time machine. It took Hall Spencer 2 years to get back to Ischia. He did not yet have funding for his project, and so he had trouble getting anyone to take him seriously. Unable to afford a hotel room, he camped out on a ledge in the cliffs. To collect samples, he used discarded plastic water bottles. It was a bit Robinson Crusoe-ish, he tells me. Eventually, he convinced enough people, including Buya, that he was onto something. Their first task was producing a detailed survey of pH levels around the island. Then they organized a census of what was living in each of the different pH zones. This involved placing metal frames along the shore and registering every mussel, barnacle, and limpet clinging to the rocks. It also involved spending hours at a stretch sitting underwater, counting passing fish. In the waters far from the vents, Hall Spencer and his colleagues found a fairly typical assemblage of Mediterranean species. These included Agalus aroides, a sponge that looks a bit like foam insulation, Sarpa salpa, a commonly consumed fish that, on occasion, causes hallucinations, and Arbacia lixula, a sea urchin with a lilac tinge. Also living in the area was Amphiroa rigida, a spiky pinkish seaweed, and Halimeda tuna, a green seaweed that grows in the shape of a series of connecting discs. The census was limited to creatures large enough to be seen with the naked eye. In this vent-free zone, 69 species of animals and 51 species of plants were counted. When Hall Spencer and his team set up their quadrants closer to the vents, the tally they came up with was very different. Balanus perforatus is a grayish barnacle that resembles a tiny volcano. It is common and abundant from West Africa to Wales. In the pH 7.8 zone, which corresponds to the seas of the not-too-distant future, Balanus perforatus was gone. Mytilus gallop provincialis, a blue-black mussel native to the Mediterranean, is so adaptable that it's established itself in many parts of the world as an invasive. It, too, was missing. Also absent were Corallina elongata and Corallina officinalis, both forms of stiff, reddish seaweed. Pomatoceros triquetur, a kind of keelworm, three species of coral, several species of snails, and Arca noe, a mollusk commonly known as Noah's Ark. All told, one-third of the species found in the vent-free zone were no-shows in the pH 7.8 zone. Unfortunately, the biggest tipping point, the one at which the ecosystem starts to crash, is mean pH 7.8, which is what we're expecting to happen by 2100. Hall Spencer tells me, in his understated British manner. So that is rather alarming. Since Hall Spencer's first paper on the vent system appeared in 2008, there has been an explosion of interest in acidification and its effects. International research projects with names like Bioacid, Biological Impacts of Ocean Acidification, and EPOCA, the European Project on Ocean Acidification, have been funded, and hundreds, perhaps thousands of experiments have been undertaken. These experiments have been conducted on board ships, in laboratories, and in enclosures known as mesocosms, which allow conditions to be manipulated on a patch of actual ocean. Again and again, these experiments have confirmed the hazards posed by rising CO2. While many species will apparently do fine, even thrive in an acidified ocean, lots of others will not. Some of the organisms that have been shown to be vulnerable, like clownfish and Pacific oysters, are familiar from aquariums and the dinner table. Others are less charismatic or tasty, but probably more essential to marine ecosystems. Emiliana huxleyi, for example, is a single-celled phytoplankton, a coccolithophore that surrounds itself with tiny calcite plates. Under magnification, it looks like some kind of crazy crafts project, a soccer ball covered in buttons. It is so common at certain times of year that it turns vast sections of the seas a milky white, and it forms the base of many marine food chains. Limacina helicina is a species of pteropod, or sea butterfly, that resembles a winged snail. It lives in the Arctic and is an important food source for many much larger animals, including heron, salmon, and whales. Both of these species appear to be highly sensitive to acidification. In one mesocosm experiment, Emiliana huxleyi disappeared altogether from enclosures with elevated CO2 levels. Ulf Ribesel is a biological oceanographer at the GMR Helmholtz Center for Ocean Research in Kiel, Germany, who has directed several major ocean acidification studies off the coasts of Norway, Finland, and Svalbard. Ribesel has found that the groups that tend to fare best in acidified water are plankton that are so tiny, less than 2 microns across, that they form their own microscopic food web. As their numbers increase, these picoplankton, as they are called, use up more nutrients, and larger organisms suffer. If you ask me what's going to happen in the future I think the strongest evidence we have is there is going to be a reduction in biodiversity, Ribasell told me. Some highly tolerant organisms will become more abundant, but overall diversity will be lost. This is what has happened in all these times of major mass extinction. Ocean acidification is sometimes referred to as global warning's equally evil twin. The irony is intentional, and fair enough as far as it goes, which may not be far enough. No single mechanism explains all the mass extinctions in the record, and yet changes in ocean chemistry seem to be a pretty good predictor. Ocean acidification played a role in at least two of the big five extinctions, the end Permian and the end Triassic, and quite possibly it was a major factor in a third, the end Cretaceous. There's strong evidence for ocean acidification during an extinction event known as the Toarcian turnover, which occurred 183 million years ago in the early Jurassic, and similar evidence at the end of the Paleocene, 55 million years ago, when several forms of marine life suffered a major crisis. Oh, ocean acidification, Zalashevich had told me at Dobbs Lynn. That's the big nasty one that's coming down. Why is ocean acidification so dangerous? The question is tough to answer, only because the list of reasons is so long. Depending on how tightly organisms are able to regulate their internal chemistry, acidification may affect such basic processes as metabolism, enzyme activity, and protein function. Because it will change the makeup of microbial communities, it will alter the availability of key nutrients, like iron and nitrogen. For similar reasons, it will change the amount of light that passes through the water. And for somewhat different reasons, it will alter the way sound propagates. In general, acidification is expected to make the seas noisier. It seems likely to promote the growth of toxic algae. It will impact photosynthesis. Many plant species are apt to benefit from elevated CO2 levels, and it will alter the compounds formed by dissolved metals, in some cases, in ways that could be poisonous. Of the myriad possible impacts, probably the most significant, involves the group of creatures known as calcifiers. The term calcifier applies to any organism that builds a shell or external skeleton, or in the case of plants, a kind of internal scaffolding out of the mineral calcium carbonate. Marine calcifiers are a fantastically varied lot. Echinoderms like starfish and sea urchins are calcifiers, as are mollusks like clams and oysters. So too are barnacles, which are crustaceans. Many species of coral are calcifiers. This is how they construct the towering structures that become reefs. Lots of kinds of seaweed are calcifiers. These often feel rigid or brittle to the touch. Coralline algae, minute organisms that grow in colonies that look like a smear of pink paint, are also calcifiers. Brachiopods are calcifiers, and so are coccolithophores, foraminifera, and many types of pteropods. The list goes on and on. It's been estimated that calcification evolved at least 24 separate times over the course of life's history, and it's quite possible that the number is higher than that. From a human perspective, calcification looks a bit like construction work, and also a bit like alchemy. To build their shells, or exoskeletons, or calcitic plates, calcifiers must join calcium ions and carbonate ions to form calcium carbonate. But at the concentrations that they're found in ordinary seawater, calcium and carbonate ions won't combine. At the site of calcification, organisms must therefore alter the chemistry of the water to, in effect, impose a chemistry of their own. Ocean acidification increases the cost of calcification by reducing the number of carbonate ions available to begin with. To extend the construction metaphor, imagine trying to build a house while someone keeps stealing your bricks. The more acidified the water, the greater the energy that's required to complete the necessary steps. At a certain point, the water becomes positively corrosive and solid calcium carbonate begins to dissolve. This is why the limpets that wander too close to the vents at Castello Arganese end up with holes in their shells. Lab experiments have indicated that calcifiers will be particularly hard hit by falling ocean pH, and the list of the disappeared at Castello Arganese confirms this. In the pH 7.8 zone, 3/4 of the missing species are calcifiers. These include the nearly ubiquitous barnacle Balanus perforatus, the hardy mussel Mytilus galloprovincialis, and the keelworm Pomatocerus triquetur. Other absent calcifiers are Lima lima, a common bivalve, Jujubina striatus, a chocolate-colored sea snail, and Serpulorbus arenarius, a mollusk known as a worm snail. Calcifying seaweed, meanwhile, is completely absent. According to geologists who work in the area, the vents at Castello Arganese have been spewing carbon dioxide for at least several hundred years, maybe longer. Any mussel or barnacle or keelworm that can adapt to lower pH in a time frame of centuries presumably already would have done so. You give them generations on generations to survive in these conditions, and yet they're not there, Hall Spencer observed. And the lower the pH drops, the worse it goes for calcifiers. Right up near the vents, where the bubbles of CO2 stream up in thick ribbons, Hall Spencer found that they are entirely absent. In fact, all that remains in this area, the underwater equivalent of a vacant lot, are a few hardy species of native algae, some species of invasive algae, one kind of shrimp, a sponge, and two kinds of sea slugs. You won't see any calcifying organisms, full stop, in the area where the bubbles are coming up, he told me. You know how normally in a polluted harbor, you've got just a few species that are weed-like and able to cope with massively fluctuating conditions? Well, it's like that when you ramp up CO2. Roughly 1/3 of the CO2 that humans have so far pumped into the air has been absorbed by the oceans. This comes to a stunning 150 billion metric tons. As with most aspects of the Anthropocene, though, it's not only the scale of the transfer, but also the speed that's significant. A useful, though admittedly imperfect, comparison can be made to alcohol. Just as it makes a big difference to your blood chemistry whether you take a month to go through a six-pack or an hour, it makes a big difference to marine chemistry whether carbon dioxide is added over the course of a million years or 100. To the oceans, as to the human liver, rate matters. If we were adding CO2 to the air more slowly, geophysical processes, like the weathering of rock, would come into play to counteract acidification. As it is, things are moving too fast for such slow-acting forces to keep up. As Rachel Carson once observed, referring to a very different, but at the same time, profoundly similar problem, time is the essential ingredient, but in the modern world, there is no time. A group of scientists, led by Burbel Harnish of Colombia's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory, recently reviewed the evidence for changing CO2 levels in the geologic past and concluded that, although there are several severe episodes of ocean acidification in the record, no past event perfectly parallels what is happening right now, owing to the unprecedented rapidity of CO2 release currently taking place. It turns out there just aren't many ways to inject billions of tons of carbon into the air very quickly. The best explanation anyone has come up with for the end Permian extinction is a massive burst of volcanism in what's now Siberia. But even this spectacular event, which created the formation known as the Siberian Traps, probably released, on an annual basis, less carbon than our cars and factories and power plants. By burning through coal and oil deposits, Humans are putting carbon back into the air that has been sequestered for tens, in most cases hundreds, of millions of years. In the process, we are running geologic history not only in reverse, but at warp speed. It is the rate of CO2 release that makes the current great experiment so geologically unusual, and quite probably unprecedented in Earth history. Lee Kump, a geologist at Penn State, and Andy Ridgewell, a climate modeler from the University of Bristol, observed in a special issue of the journal Oceanography, devoted to acidification. Continuing along this path for much longer, the pair continued, is likely to leave a legacy of the Anthropocene as one of the most notable, if not cataclysmic, events in the history of our planet. Chapter 7. Dropping Acid. Acropora, Millepora. Half a world away from Castello Arganese, One Tree Island sits at the southernmost tip of the Great Barrier Reef, about 50 miles off the coast of Australia. It has more than one tree, which surprised me when I got there, expecting, cartoonishly I suppose, a single palm sticking up out of white sand. As it turned out, there wasn't any sand either. The whole island consists of pieces of coral rubble, ranging in size from small marbles to huge boulders. Like the living corals they were once part of, the rubble chunks come in dozens of forms. Some are stubby and finger-shaped, others branching, like a candelabra. Still others resemble antlers or dinner plates or bits of brain. It is believed that One Tree Island was created during a particularly vicious storm that occurred some 4,000 years ago. As one geologist who has studied the place put it to me, you wouldn't have wanted to be there when that happened. The island is still in the process of changing shape. A storm that passed through in March 2009, Cyclone Hamish, added a ridge that runs along the island's eastern shore. One Tree would qualify as deserted, except for a tiny research station operated by the University of Sydney. I travel to the island, as just about everyone does, from another slightly larger island about 12 miles away. That island is known as Heron Island, also a misnomer, since at Heron there are no herons. When we docked, or really moored, since One Tree has no dock, a loggerhead turtle was heaving herself out of the water onto the shore. She was nearly 4 feet long, with a large welt on her shell, which was encrusted with ancient-looking barnacles. News travels fast on a nearly deserted island, and soon the entire human population of One Tree, 12 people including me, had come out to watch. Sea turtles usually lay their eggs at night, on sandy beaches. This was in the middle of the day, on jagged coral rubble. The turtle tried to dig a hole with her back flippers. After much exertion, she produced a shallow trough. By this point, one of her flippers was bleeding. She heaved herself farther up the shore and tried again, with similar results. She was still at it an hour and a half later, when I had to go get a safety lecture from the manager of the research station, Russell Graham. He warned me not to go swimming when the tide was going out, as I might find myself swept off to Fiji. This was a line I would hear repeated many times during my stay, though there was some disagreement about whether the current was heading toward Fiji or really away from it. Once I'd taken in this and other advisories, the bite of a blue-ringed octopus is usually fatal, the sting of a stonefish is not, but it is so painful it will make you wish it were, I went back to see how the turtle was doing. Apparently she had given up and crawled back into the sea. The One Tree Island Research Station is a bare-bones affair. It consists of two makeshift labs, a pair of cabins, and an outhouse with a composting toilet. The cabins rest directly on the rubble, for the most part with no floor, so that even when you're indoors, you feel as if you're out. Teams of scientists from all around the world book themselves into the station for stays of a few weeks or a few months. At one point, Someone must have decided that every team should leave a record of its visit on the cabin walls. "Getting to the core in 2004, reads one inscription, drawn in magic marker. Others include, "The Crab Crew, Claws for a Cause, 2005. Coral Sex, 2008. The Fluorescence Team, 2009. The American-Israeli team that was in residence at the time of my arrival had already made two trips to the island. The epigram from its first visit, "Dropping Acid on Corals," was accompanied by a sketch of a syringe dripping what looked like blood onto a globe. The group's latest message referred to its study site, a patch of coral known as DK-13. DK-13 lies out on the reef, far enough away from the station that, for the purposes of communication, it might as well be on the moon. The writing on the wall said, "DK-13, no one can hear you scream." The first European to encounter the Great Barrier Reef was Captain James Cook. In the spring of 1770, Cook was sailing along the east coast of Australia when his ship, the Endeavour, rammed into a section of the reef about 30 miles southeast of what is now, not coincidentally, Cooktown. Everything dispensable, including the ship's cannon, was tossed overboard, and the leaky Endeavour managed to creak ashore, where the crew spent the next 2 months repairing its hull. Cook was flummoxed by what he described as a wall of coral rock rising almost perpendicular out of the unfathomable ocean. He understood that the reef was biological in origin, that it had been formed in the sea by animals. But how, then, he would later ask, had it come to be thrown up to such a height? The question of how coral reefs arose was still an open one 60 years later, when Lyell sat down to write The Principles. Although he had never seen a reef, Lyell was fascinated by them, and he devoted part of Volume 2 to speculating about their origins. Lyell's theory, that reefs grew from the rims of extinct underwater volcanoes, he borrowed more or less wholesale from a Russian naturalist named Johann Friedrich von Eschholtz. Before Bikini Atoll became Bikini Atoll, it was called, rather less enticingly, Eschholtz Atoll. When his turn came to theorize about reefs, Darwin had the advantage of actually having visited some. In November 1835, the Beagle moored off Tahiti. Darwin climbed to one of the highest points on the island, and from there he could survey the neighboring island of Morea. Morea, he observed, was encircled by a reef, the way a framed etching is surrounded by a mat. "I am glad that we have visited these islands," Darwin wrote in his diary, "for coral reefs rank high amongst the wonderful objects in the world." Looking over at Morea and its surrounding reef, he pictured time running forward. If the island were to sink away, Morea's reef would become an atoll. When Darwin returned to London and shared his subsistence theory with Lyell, Lyell, though impressed, foresaw resistance. "Do not flatter yourself that you will be believed until you are growing bald like me," he warned. In fact, debate about Darwin's theory, the subject of his 1842 book, The Structure and Distribution of Coral Reefs, continued until the 1950s, when the U.S. Navy arrived in the Marshall Islands with plans to vaporize some of them. In preparation for the H-bomb tests, the Navy drilled a series of cores on an atoll called Enewetok. As one of Darwin's biographers put it, these cores proved his theory to be, in its large lines at least, astoundingly correct. Darwin's description of coral reefs as amongst the wonderful objects of the world also still stands. Indeed, the more that has been learned about reefs, the more marvelous they seem. Reefs are organic paradoxes, obdurate, ship-destroying ramparts, constructed by tiny gelatinous creatures. They are part animal, part vegetable, and part mineral, at once teeming with life and at the same time, mostly dead. Like sea urchins and starfish and clams and oysters and barnacles, reef-building corals have mastered the alchemy of calcification. What sets them apart from other calcifiers is that instead of working solo to produce a shell, say, or some calcitic plates, corals engage in vast communal building projects that stretch over generations. Each individual, known unflatteringly as a polyp, adds to its colony's collective exoskeleton. On a reef, billions of polyps belonging to as many as 100 different species are all devoting themselves to this same basic task. Given enough time and the right conditions, the result is another paradox, a living structure. The Great Barrier Reef extends, discontinuously, for more than 1,500 miles, and in some places, it is 500 feet thick. By the scale of reefs, the pyramids at Giza are kitty blocks. The way corals change the world, with huge construction projects spanning multiple generations, might be likened to the way that humans do, with this crucial difference. Instead of displacing other creatures, corals support them. Thousands, perhaps millions, of species have evolved to rely on coral reefs, either directly for protection or food, or indirectly to prey on those species that come seeking protection or food. This co-evolutionary venture has been underway for many geologic epochs. Researchers now believe it won't last out the Anthropocene. It is likely that reefs will be the first major ecosystem in the modern era to become ecologically extinct, is how a trio of British scientists recently put it. Some give reefs until the end of the century, others less time even than that. A paper published in Nature by the former head of the One Tree Island Research Station, Ove Hoeg Goldberg, predicted that if current trends continue, then by around 2050, visitors to the Great Barrier Reef will arrive to find rapidly eroding rubble banks. I came to One Tree more or less by accident. My original plan had been to stay on Heron Island, where there's a much larger research station, and also a ritzy resort. On Heron, I was going to watch the annual coral spawning and observe what had been described to me in various Skype conversations as a seminal experiment on ocean acidification. Researchers from the University of Queensland were building an elaborate plexiglass mesocosm that was going to allow them to manipulate CO2 levels on a patch of reef, even as it allowed the various creatures that depend on the reef to swim in and out. By changing the pH inside the mesocosm and measuring what happened to the corals, they were going to be able to generate predictions about the reef as a whole. I arrived at Heron in time to see the spawning, more on this later, but the experiment was way behind schedule, and the mesocosm still in pieces. Instead of the reef of the future, all there was to see was a bunch of anxious graduate students hunched over soldering irons in the lab. As I was trying to figure out what to do next, I heard about another experiment on corals and ocean acidification that was underway at One Tree, which, by the scale of the Great Barrier Reef, lies just around the corner. 3 days later, there is no regular transportation to One Tree, I managed to get a boat over. The head of the team at One Tree was an atmospheric scientist named Ken Caldera. Caldera, who's based at Stanford, is often credited with having coined the term ocean acidification. He became interested in the subject in the late 1990s when he was hired to do a project for the Department of Energy. The department wanted to know what the consequences would be of capturing carbon dioxide from smokestacks and injecting it into the deep sea. At that point, almost no modeling work had been done on the effects of carbon emissions on the oceans. Caldera set about calculating how the ocean's pH would change as a result of deep-sea injection, and then compared that result with the current practice of pumping CO2 into the atmosphere and allowing it to be absorbed by surface waters. In 2003, he submitted his results to Nature. The journal's editors advised him to drop the discussion of deep ocean injection because the calculations concerning the effects of ordinary atmospheric release were so startling. Caldera published the first part of his paper under the subheading, "The coming centuries may see more ocean acidification than the past 300 million years." Under business as usual, by mid-century things are looking rather grim, he told me a few hours after I had arrived at One Tree. We were sitting at a beat-up picnic table, looking out over the heartbreaking blue of the Coral Sea. The island's large and boisterous population of terns was screaming in the background. Caldera paused. I mean, they're looking grim already. Caldera, who is in his mid-50s, has curly brown hair, a boyish smile, and a voice that tends to rise toward the end of sentences, so that it often seems he is posing a question, even when he's not. Before getting into research, he worked as a software developer on Wall Street. One of his clients was the New York Stock Exchange, for whom he designed a computer program to detect insider trading. The program functioned as it was supposed to, but after a while Caldera came to believe that the NYSE wasn't really interested in catching inside traders, and he decided to switch professions. Unlike most atmospheric scientists, who focus on one particular aspect of the system, Caldera is, at any given moment, working on four or five disparate projects. He particularly likes computations of a provocative or surprising nature. For example, he once calculated that cutting down all the world's forests and replacing them with grasslands would have a slight cooling effect. Grasslands, which are lighter in color than forests, absorb less sunlight. Other calculations of his show that to keep pace with the present rate of temperature change, plants and animals would have to migrate poleward by 30 feet a day, and that a molecule of CO2 generated by burning fossil fuels will, in the course of its lifetime in the atmosphere, trap 100,000 times more heat than was released in producing it. At One Tree, life for Caldera and his team revolved around the tides. An hour before the first low tide of the day, and then an hour afterward, someone had to collect water samples out at DK-13, so named because the Australian researcher who had set up the site, Donald Kinsey, had labeled it with his initials. A little more than 12 hours later, the process would be repeated, and so on, from one low tide to the next. The experiment was slow-tech rather than high-tech. The idea was to measure various properties of the water that Kinsey had measured back in the 1970s, then compare the two sets of data and try to tease out how calcification rates on the reef had changed in the intervening decades. In daylight, the trip to DK-13 could be made by one person. In the dark, in deference to the fact that no one can hear you scream, the rule was that two had to go. My first evening on One Tree, low tide fell at 8:53 p.m. Caldera was making the post-low tide trip, and I volunteered to go with him. At around 9 o'clock, we gathered up half a dozen sampling bottles, a pair of flashlights, and a handheld GPS unit, and started out. From the research station, it was about a mile walk to DK-13. The route, which someone had plugged into the GPS unit, led around the southern tip of the island and over a slick expanse of rubble that had been nicknamed the Algal Highway. From there, it veered out onto the reef itself. Since corals like light but can't survive long exposure to the air, they tend to grow as high as the water level at low tide and then spread out laterally. This produces an expansive reef that's more or less flat, like a series of tables, which can be crossed the way a kid, after school, might jump from desk to desk. The surface of One Tree's reef flat was brittle and brownish, and was known around the research station as the pie crust. It crackled ominously underfoot. Caldera warned me that if I fell through, It would be bad for the reef, and even worse for my shins. I recalled another message I had seen penned on the wall of the research station. Don't trust the pie crust. The night was balmy, and beyond the beams of our flashlights, pitch black. Even in the dark, the extraordinary vitality of the reef was evident. We passed several loggerhead turtles wading out low tide with what looked like bored expressions. We encountered bright blue starfish, and leopard sharks stranded in shallow pools, and ruddy octopuses doing their best to blend into the reef. Every few feet, we had to step over a giant clam, which appeared to be leering with garishly painted lips. The mantles of giant clams are packed with colorful symbiotic algae. The sandy strips between the blocks of coral were littered with sea cucumbers, which, despite the name, are animals whose closest relations are sea urchins. On the Great Barrier Reef, the sea cucumbers are the size not of cucumbers, but of bolster cushions. Out of curiosity, I decided to pick one up. It was about 2 feet long and inky black. It felt like slime-covered velvet. After a few wrong turns, and several delays, while Caldera tried to photograph the octopuses with a waterproof camera, we reached DK-13. The site consisted of nothing more than a yellow buoy and some sensing equipment anchored to the reef with a rope. I glanced back in what I thought was the direction of the island, but there was no island or land of any sort to be seen. We rinsed out the sampling bottles, filled them, and started back. The darkness was, if anything, even more complete. The stars were so bright they appeared to be straining out of the sky. For a brief moment, I felt I understood what it must have been like for an explorer like Cook to arrive at such a place, at the edge of the known world. Coral reefs grow in a great swath that stretches like a belt around the belly of the earth. From 30 degrees north to 30 degrees south latitude. After the Great Barrier Reef, the world's second largest reef is off the coast of Belize. There are extensive coral reefs in the tropical Pacific, in the Indian Ocean, and in the Red Sea, and many smaller ones in the Caribbean. Yet, curiously enough, the first evidence that CO2 could kill a reef came from Arizona, from the self-enclosed, supposedly self-sufficient world known as Biosphere 2. A 3-acre glassed-in structure shaped like a ziggurat, Biosphere 2 was built in the late 1980s by a private group largely funded by the billionaire Edward Bass. It was intended to demonstrate how life on Earth, Biosphere 1, could be recreated on, say, Mars. The building contained a rainforest, a desert, an agricultural zone, and an artificial ocean. The first group of biospherians, 4 men and 4 women, remained sealed inside the place for 2 years. They grew all of their own food, and for a stretch, breathed only recycled air. Still, the project was widely considered a failure. The biospherians spent much of their time hungry, and even more ominously, they lost control of their artificial atmosphere. In the various ecosystems, decomposition, which takes up oxygen and gives off carbon dioxide, was supposed to be balanced by photosynthesis, which does the reverse. For reasons mainly having to do with the richness of the soil that had been imported into the agricultural zone, decomposition won out. Oxygen levels inside the building fell sharply, and the biospherians developed what amounted to altitude sickness. Carbon dioxide levels, meanwhile, soared. Eventually, they reached 3,000 parts per million, roughly 8 times the levels outside. Biosphere 2 officially collapsed in 1995, and Columbia University took over the management of the building. The ocean, a tank the size of an Olympic swimming pool, was by this point a wreck. Most of the fish it had been stocked with were dead, and the corals were just barely hanging on. A marine biologist named Chris Langdon was assigned the task of figuring out something educational to do with the tank. His first step was to adjust the water chemistry. Not surprisingly, given the high CO2 content of the air, the pH of the ocean